A view of the steel tariffs from a company caught uncomfortably in the middle. Also, and I know I've said this before, people, but please listen to the bond market. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday today, the 28th day of March. Good as always to have you here, everybody. The South Korea trade deal we told you a couple of days ago was going to happen has formally happened. Both sides made the actual announcement today. Lots in the thing, of course. Cars, a clause on currency manipulation, also steel. South Korea gets out from under the steel tariffs that went into effect last Friday, but in return will limit how much steel it sends here. And by here, I mean here. Los Angeles, about 6 miles south of Marketplace World headquarters in downtown, sits Hannibal Industries, the biggest manufacturer in the western part of the United States of steel pallet racks. They take rolled steel and turn it into racks and tubes used for those giant shelving units you see in warehouses in places like Costco. Oh, yeah, now look at this. It's actually real heavy industry. It is noisy, giant stamping machines all over the place.
And those rolls are just steel. It's just rolls. It's cold. Just rolls and rolls of steel.
I made my way inside the corporate offices. Executive Vice President Steve Rogers and I sat for a bit, and I started with what tariffs or the threat of tariffs have meant for him in real terms.
Listen, any business likes stability, right? You like to have some kind of forward look as to what your supply is going to be and some idea of what it's going to cost. Now, being in the steel industry now for 30 years, we're used to volatility. If you look at the price of steel on the CRU, you know...
CRU.
CRU. It's a steel index.
Got it.
Okay. So a low of $350 a ton, a high now of $886, $890.
Wow.
And, you know, over that last 10 years, it's been volatile. But this is a little bit different. This is not just a pricing volatility, but a supply... A pinch on the supply, especially on the West Coast.
Does it feel different or is it actually different yet? I mean, these tariffs have only been in the news like a month?
Been in the news a month, been percolating for about a year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those of us in the industry have kind of been waiting and waiting and waiting and waiting. And last month, it came to a crescendo. But there's still so much, it's so fluid. And it looks like South Korea is going to continue to supply steel to the United States at about 70% of their average between 2015 and 2017.
And that's good news for you.
It is. On the West Coast, it is.
Yeah.
Now, you got to remember, on the West Coast, we only have one hot roll mill, okay? So this isn't the heart of the steel country.
When you say hot roll mill, you mean the big, scary-looking furnaces?
That... Correct.
Okay.
Correct. So that's our raw material, right?
Got it.
Flat roll steel.
Yep.
We only have one mill on the West Coast. So
you need foreign imports.
Absolutely. The United States does.
Okay? Well,
there's more demand for steel in the United States than overall capacity.
Explain that a little bit, because the Trump administration's line has been, we're going to increase domestic production. You see plants coming online and 500 people being hired in steel mills back east. Is that not going to do it for you?
You know, I try to stay out of the politics of it.
Yeah, no,
really,
I get that.
Really, what I'm interested in is having a stable steel supply, especially to the West Coast, because we're primarily centric to the West Coast.
Let me ask the same question in a different way. Can the domestic steel industry supply what you need?
Supply what we need or what? Supply on a macro?
Domestic demand.
No.
Of which you are a part.
No. No.
Are you already seeing increases in the price of your raw materials?
Yes.
How much?
I've seen 30 to 35%.
Wow. And are you're passing those costs on?
We're trying to. But well, at some point, there's a threshold.
Yeah.
So let's say you're going to expand your warehouse.
Yep. Need more shelves and tubular steel.
Your business is good.
Yep.
And so you've got a plan, and you've got an ROI on the equipment to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that is our product, right?
Yep.
So let's say it's $1 million. And that gets signed off, and the ROI looks good, and the expansion plan goes on. And now it's $1.5 million.
$1.3 million, yeah, right?
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, that at some point changes the calculus, and people either believe this is temporary, so I'm going to put it on hold, or, you know, if that's going to be the cost, then we're not ready to do it.
Are your customers coming to you and saying, hey, Steve, man, I can't make this one now. I can't do it.
Not yet.
You expecting
not
it?
Yet. I don't know what to expect because I really don't know how it's going to shake out. Again, it's so fluid, Kai. It's so fluid. I mean, what we learned today gave our company a little comfort in that our supply may not be pinched as hard as it has been for the last 2 months. So, I mean, 2 months ago, there was no foreign offering for steel, at least to the West Coast.
Right.
They just, you know, there was too much uncertainty, and you're talking about a 25% tariff.
So foreign steelmakers preemptively said, we're just going to hold off in the
American
market
for a while. We're going to hold off. Exactly. To ramp up steel production in the United States takes time. Mm-hmm. And so the domestic mills are taking care of their customer base, first the contractual customers, right? And then people like us who buy on the spot market, there was allocation happening. And mills, domestic mills would say, we're only going to allow you to buy X number of tons a month.
Wow.
Yeah.
I appreciate you not wanting to get into the politics of this.
Good.
Well, yes, but wait for the question. A lot has been made of the desire to protect American steel jobs with these tariffs. What's not talked about so much by the administration are the many, 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 many more jobs in this economy that depend downstream
on steel. Downstream manufacturers.
And it seems to me you are at that fulcrum where the steel jobs translate into those jobs downstream.
Correct. That's right. Downstream manufacturers potentially could get squeezed with higher input costs while still having to compete with foreign finished goods.
That was Steve Rogers of Hannibal Industries, technically, by the way, in Vernon, California. We shot a little video while we were there, the steel industry at work in Southern California. Check it out on YouTube. We're Marketplace APM. On Wall Street today, a whole lot of bouncing around for stocks. Then things basically finished even. The macroeconomic word of the day, though, on this Wednesday, bonds. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. So, bonds. Two varieties of bond stories today, corporate and treasuries. We are going to start with T-bills, treasury bills, government debt, and the yield, the interest rate those bonds pay. The Federal Reserve, as we have been telling you, wants interest rates in this economy to go up. The bond market, though, has some other ideas. The yield on the benchmark 10-year treasury note has been going down. Marketplace's Mariel Segarra explains what's going on.
A treasury bond is a loan you give to the U.S. government. In return, the government pays you a certain amount in interest. Investors buy these bonds every day, and depending on what's going on in the economy, they demand higher or lower interest rates. Jeff Mills is a managing director at PNC.
The market, the people that are buying those treasury bonds, they're the ones who determine the compensation that they require.
Now, the Federal Reserve has been hiking interest rates. That makes it more lucrative to lend money. The theory is that would trickle down to the bond market. James Angel at Georgetown's McDonough School of Business says, remember, bond buyers are lenders too.
And what the lenders are going to do is they're going to try to get the biggest return on their money.
They've got options. And if they can get higher interest rates elsewhere, they're going to demand them from Uncle Sam too. This is what's supposed to happen. But lately, it's not. One reason? The stock market. It's been down thanks to news about tariffs and fears of a possible trade war. Kathy Jones at Charles Schwab says that's making bonds look pretty good.
When the stock market tumbles like that, people say, oh, just I got to get my money out and put it someplace safe. And treasury bonds are safe.
That means demand for bonds is going up. So the U.S. government doesn't have to pay those higher interest rates because it's got a lot of potential buyers. And that's why even though the Fed is hiking interest rates, the bond market is moving in the opposite direction. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
The corporate bond story today comes to us from Tesla, would-be electric car maker to the world. The company's credit rating was downgraded this week because it continues to underperform on a couple of business fundamentals, things like making money or even making enough of its product. Moody's now describes the company's recently issued bonds as, quote, very high credit risk. Marketplace's Ryan Kyloth has that one.
Tesla's been losing money for so long, it's easy to forget that wasn't always the plan. The original plan, right from the very beginning, was they would launch each generation of cars and use the money they make from those vehicles to fund the next generation, which would be higher volume, more affordable.
Says Sam Abu El Samid, analyst at Navigant Research. The Roadster would pay for the Model S, which would pay for the Model 3. Profits on profits on profits, all the way to Mars.
Unfortunately, along the way, they ran into a little glitch in that none of those generations of vehicles up until now have actually been profitable.
So the plan changed. Tesla went to the stock markets with a new pitch. Go big or go home. We're inventing the future over here, but it's not going to be cheap.
Tesla is in an industry that consumes so much capital.
That's John Thompson of Vilas Capital.
For them to come out with a semi-truck, need a new factory. Model Y, need another new factory. Solar roofs, need another factory.
After a certain point, Tesla couldn't issue more stock without diluting its shareholder base. So it turned to issuing bonds. But bond raters need more than just a good story. As Hithin Anand of Credit Site says very politely,
if you apply the traditional credit analysis framework, not many people would be excited about these bonds.
The Moody's credit downgrade will make it harder for Tesla to raise more money now, which means the story that it tells investors may have to change again. In New York, I'm Ryan Kailath for Marketplace.
Don't look now, but Facebook says it's going to make it easier for users to see and maybe change some of the data that's being collected on them. It is a project, the company says, that was in the works before all of the recent unpleasantness. Marketplace's Rima Kreis looks at what the changes might mean for Facebook and for you.
Like lots of Facebook users, I thought it might be a good time to check my privacy settings. Okay, so I'm on my phone right now on the app. I'm going to click on privacy shortcuts, who can contact me, how to block someone. Okay, not really what I'm looking for. I want to know what info I'm sharing on apps. So do I need to go back to settings and click on the apps tab? Ugh, forget it.
It's really difficult to keep up with controlling your information in such a complex system.
William McGeverin teaches data privacy at the University of Minnesota Law School. He says instead of making users go through 20 different screens, Facebook is grouping all privacy security settings in one place.
For ordinary users, more transparency is going to be eye-opening.
Facebook says it's also going to make it easier for users to control what information they share with advertisers and to review data collected on them. McGeverin says these are all good steps. But other privacy experts like University of North Carolina professor Zeynep Tufekci disagree.
As long as the default is tracking, and as long as it seems like the burden is on the user, we are not going to get anywhere.
Tufekci says most users still won't bother tweaking their settings. And she says because Facebook's entire business model relies on collecting as much data on us as possible, it'll never be that easy to keep your data private.
I don't mind tweaks. I don't mind Band-Aids, but here we need surgery. What we need is a different kind of digital business where we are the customer, not the product.
And she says that would require a total rethinking of how Facebook operates. I'm Rima Kreis for Marketplace.
Coming up,
will the boards, the recruiters, have the faith that these women can, in fact, take the reins and lead this company into the future?
One hopes, right? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials were off 9 points today, closed at 23,848. NASDAQ down 59 points, about 0.8%. 69.49. The S&P 500 dropped 7 points, about 0.2% there, 26.05. Yogaware maker Lululemon stretched up 9.2% today after posting fourth quarter sales and earnings that beat analysts' forecasts. Same story with the Walgreens Boots Alliance, minus the stretching joke. The pharmacy chain gained 2.4% today on better-than-expected quarterly sales and earnings. Amazon dropped 4.3% after the news website Axios reported that President Trump is considering ways to rein in the online retail conglomerate with antitrust or competition laws. Spokeswoman, press secretary, rather, Sarah Huckabee Sanders said there are no current plans at the White House to do that. You're listening to Marketplace. Hey, I'm Kai Rizdahl.
And I'm Molly Wood.
And we are back with our podcast, Make Me Smart, asking people the question that never fails to get a great answer.
I would say...
Eventually.
What is something that you thought you knew and then later found out you were wrong about? Take a moment, take a breath, think about it.
It's going to take a while.
Tell us your answers.
Check us out at makemesmart.org or wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. After years of being stuck, wages in this economy have finally started going up. Workers with the right skills in a tight labor market are finding they can shop around a little bit. Same thing in China, kind of. The comparison is imprecise because there are hundreds of millions more workers there than there are here. But the 2 months after Lunar New Year are traditionally known as job hunting season. Marketplace of China correspondent Jennifer Pak has that one from Shanghai.
A job fair at a mid-level Shanghai hotel. More than 100 bewildered job hunters mill around dozens of booths set up by eager employers. Some recruiters are so fired up, they're grabbing job seekers in the hallways outside. You looking for a job? This woman asks. Come and see what we have, says this man. Most of the recruiters are here because business is booming and they need more workers, or because their staff have quit. Chen Zhiqi is with the leading job site, Zhaopin. Employees usually receive their annual bonuses before the lunar year, so those who want to change jobs will do it after the holiday. Sometimes it can happen abruptly. Deng Shiheng is a sales executive at Huijia Fitness.
I had a colleague who received his annual bonus, then left the next day at noon. That was a bit much.
Deng Shiheng himself has switched industries at least 4 times over the last 8 years. He's part of the so-called job-hopping generation, whose members will quit readily if they can get better salary or benefits with another employer. Other workers, like Wang Jingyi, say salary is important, but it's just as important to like the job.
And I need to know if there's space for promotions and good prospects in the industry.
This is a shift from her parents' and grandparents' generation, who knew what it was like not to have enough to eat and rated job stability more highly. But Wang Jingyi is not here today to look for work. She's a manager at China Life Insurance, and she's come to recruit. So how many people quit her company over the holiday period? She wouldn't say, but she did tell me she's looking to fill 20 positions.
It's hard to retain talent. Not many people have the persistence needed to do a sales job.
A 2016 study by the networking site LinkedIn found that only 1 out of 8 workers in China stayed in the same industry for more than 2 decades. That's half the number of people who did the same in the U.S. and Canada. So how do firms in China cope? Janet Hu is a headhunter with Jishi Talent. She says some firms are wising up to the post-New Year exodus.
Some companies will split the bonus, sometimes into 3 payments, to prevent sudden talent loss.
Other firms rely on perks. Chen Rei is with a Hong Kong design company called Yirong International. He's looking to recruit 15 people for the Shanghai office.
For employees who have worked with us for more than 3 years, we will give their parents cash and gifts twice a year.
He says the company offers other benefits, such as no compulsory overtime work and giving workers Saturdays off, which is unusual in China.
We also organize training each month and travel tours for the staff twice a year.
And if all that doesn't tempt employees to stay, the companies can look for new ones in what has become the job season, when recruitment fairs like this one are held somewhere in China almost every day. In Shanghai, I'm Jennifer Pak for Marketplace.
There are still way more male CEOs out there than female CEOs, by a long shot, as we all know. Also, more male COOs, chief operating officers, than female COOs. But in the tech industry, it's some of the high-growth names that is possibly, maybe, changing. Places like Airbnb and Pinterest and the video streaming platform Twitch all have women in the number 2 spot. Why and what that might suggest is the subject of a piece by Lee Gallagher. She is an editor-at-large at Fortune magazine, also one of our Friday regulars. Lee, it's great to talk to you.
Kai, great to be here. Thank you.
It's weird, though, not on a Friday, right? I mean, you know.
I know. I can't, like, get my arms around it.
Do me a favor, would you, and help us all understand what exactly a COO does, would you?
Well, it's funny. That's precisely kind of the hard thing. It's sort of a shapeshifter because it really varies company to company, industry to industry, and even CEO to CEO. Hmm. But it's effectively, you know, second banana. It's number two.
Right.
And in old sort of Fortune 500 arena that's sort of used as a succession tool itself, executives are often put in that role with the understanding that they'll take the top role. But what I really looked at was the way the role has evolved and is evolving in the tech world,
right,
which is a very different beast.
Well, let me actually get back to, it's not the origin myth, certainly, but in Silicon Valley and for the purposes of this piece, Sheryl Sandberg at Facebook is sort of the ground zero, right?
Yes, she was ground zero, patient zero in this whole trend. And one of the reasons why we see so many female COOs is because everyone wants, quote unquote, a Sheryl. I have a source in the story who says people think they can get a Sheryl as if it's just as simple as ordering one on Amazon. I mean, like it's a thing. And that's true. And look, I mean, Sheryl Sandberg was brought into Facebook when Facebook didn't have a business model, didn't know how it was going to make money, was not making money. Within 3 years, it had just totally professionalized, monetized, and, you know, granted, they're in the foxhole dealing with its biggest crisis to date now, as we know. But that partnership has really been something that many credit as for the company's success.
Okay, so let me break it down from there and ask you two related questions. One is there something about high-growth technology companies that lends themselves to COOs who are women of high ability? And also, what is it about these women? Because there is certainly a type of woman that you profile in this piece who has the character attributes that make these companies sing.
So the first is, what is it about tech? Well, there's one thing in particular, and it is young male founders. We will have more females one day, but it's mostly male. What's shifted is that the VCs who used to bring in sort of what was called adult supervision in the form of a seasoned executive, witness Eric Schmidt at Google or Meg Whitman at eBay, that's not happening anymore because there's so much competition to be able to fund these companies that being founder-friendly has become an important principle for the VCs to have. So the founders are staying, and that requires the need for a really strong number two. And so why women? Well, a couple things. I mean, I think there's a lot of seasoned talent out there. I think that's one thing. Number two, you know, you want to be careful about saying these things, but I think, you know, we know that the way men and women lead are different.
Yeah.
Women over-index on humility, and they're very good consensus builders, very good at multitasking. And these are all the things that are required to be a really good number two.
Do you think that this current crop, as it were, of female COOs in Silicon Valley means in, I don't know, 10 years? Because some of these women are young, right? I mean, do you suppose it means in 10 years we're going to see a bunch of female CEOs at these companies?
Well, that's the big question. And that is what we're waiting to see. And I think it's going to be shorter than 10 years. I think, I mean, one of the sources in the story said, we'll know in 2 to 5 years. These women are going to be ready to be poached for these top CEO jobs, whether it's, you know, at their existing companies or more likely at a different company. And that could be in tech. Right. It could be in another company because every company is trying to be a tech company now. So we'll know. And the only question is, will the boards, the recruiters, the hirers, you know, have the faith that these women can, in fact, take the reins and lead this company into the future?
Well, look, then you got to get the boards out of the bro culture thing, right? I mean, that's the deal with Silicon Valley.
Right. Well, that's another reason why this is happening. Having a woman COO lets you say, we are diversifying our C-suite, everyone.
Yeah.
And they are. Listen, this is a very senior role. I don't mean to downplay the significance of having all these women in this tippy-top role. It's important because then they bring in more women in other roles. But I think everybody knows that we need more women CEOs. So here's a whole bunch of pre-qualified, really competent ones right there ready for it.
Lee Gallagher, editor-at-large at Fortune Magazine, writing about COOs in Silicon Valley who just happen to be women. Lee, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Kai.
There is a bit more of my conversation with Lee that we couldn't make fit for the radio, including Sheryl Sandberg and whether she might ever leave Facebook. You can hear that bit on our Corner Office podcast. Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. The
This final note on the way out today, in which I encourage American dog owners to be more open-minded. The American Kennel Club's most popular dog rankings are out, and for the 27th year in a row, any guesses? Labrador Retrievers are on top. I mean, they're nice dogs, but 27 years in a row? The top five goes like this: German Shepherds, Golden Retrievers, French Bulldogs. What is up with that, by the way? And then regular Bulldogs. My personal favorite, although not currently a breed I own, Greater Swiss Mountain Dogs, came in at 74. All right, we got to go. After a crazy couple of days, reasonably calm on Wall Street today, the Dow was off 9 points, just a tad. The NASDAQ down 59, about 0.8%. S&P 500 dropped 7 points, 0.2%. Sarah Bruguer, Jake Gorski, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Dan Powell, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.